Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Your podcast for you.
About antiques.
So, do you want to know what we're talking about today?
Yes.
I was inspired by talking about the goldfinch.
Uh-huh.
And so I decided to do a little talking about Hepplewhite.
Oh.
Yeah. Because, you know, and on our goldfinch episode, go listen to it. We talk about Hepplewhite briefly. It's a book about antique furniture largely. So I thought it might be fun to explain literally anything about Hepplewhite, because it occurred to me that, like, probably a lot of people don't know.
What am Hepplewhite?
Well, Hepplewhite is a style of furniture. The end.
Sources for this episode include...
Common sin. So, Hepplewhite is considered one of the most influential styles of furniture of all time. It's frequently lumped in with what you call the Big Three, which includes Chippendale and Sheraton style, which, you know, probably you've heard of those before, at least in passing.
We did do an entire episode on Chippendale.
Yeah, I'm hoping you heard the... If you haven't, check it out. It's a fun one. We make a lot of jokes about strippers. So the one thing about George Hepplewhite, for which the Hepplewhite furniture is named, is he may not have existed.
Interesting. I can certainly say that the antiques business has not lobbed that at me before.
So it's
ghost furniture? Is this a furniture cryptid?
Furniture cryptid is a little bit closer. I like that, yeah.
Okay.
George Hepplewhite is a furniture cryptid, and I actually think there might be more evidence of Bigfoot than George Hepplewhite.
We don't even have Hepplewhite prints?
We don't even have his feet. No one's seen his corpse. No one's smelt his stank. Like, I'm just gonna be honest with you. I have more faith in Bigfoot.
Dang.
part of this was when I was compiling the facts so I could get them right. I was surprised in hindsight that no one talks about this. Because if you have a conversation with your average furniture dealer about Hepplewhite, they will not hint to you even slightly that there is something deeply, terribly wrong with the beginnings of this furniture.
Do tell.
So, he was born, maybe?
Okay.
Probably in Durham County, England. But Lancasters also claim that he was born there, and actually no record exists except of a man named George Hepplewhite, with no provable ties to the furniture maker George Hepplewhite.
So is he the Loch Ness Monster, or...?
He's a little more concrete than that, but less than Bigfoot.
We have photos of the Loch Ness Monster.
We have one. So, there was a George Hepplewhite born in 1727.
Okay.
So there was someone named George Hepplewhite, and after many, 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 like, decades after his death, the famous cabinet maker named Gillows, who I believe actually gets name dropped in a couple of Austen novels, he claimed to have been the master of George Hepplewhite.
So he claims to have taught this guy who may or may not have been born.
Notably only after it became famous. That'll become important.
All right.
Or, like, I'm pretty sure you're already kind of getting, like, okay, so he didn't immediately, like, it took a long time for anyone to even get that idea. He probably, we do have some more evidence of this, probably had a shop in London in St. Giles Parish at Cripplegate, which is just the most English thing.
Cripplegate. Yeah, Cripplegate.
Fantastic. Love London.
My other favorite style of furniture.
Cripplegate, yeah. Hepplewhite and Cripplegate. There was probably a shop there. Again, there is actually a stunning lack of evidence that the shop existed. Right down to tax records, licenses, they don't exist.
Alright.
There was a George Hepplewhite in the London Society of Cabinet Makers, which is actually the most concrete evidence we have that the man existed, and that he was probably associated with cabinet making. The very, very limited records we have of his business, one, and notably these were supposedly kept by him, this could never be proven, one says that a chair design had been, quote, executed with good effect for the Prince of Wales. Here's the thing. The royals, including the Prince of Wales, had zero account of ever purchasing this chair. And the one class of people who did keep very good records was the royalty.
Ghost chair.
So Hepplewhite maybe had a fever dream of a chair he sold to the Prince of Wales that never happened. And this gets crazier because he will become known for being the designer for the Prince of Wales, despite the fact that this probably never happened.
Okay.
Here's the one thing we absolutely know as a stone cold fact. He died.
Okay. So he's definitely for sure deceased.
See, he was most likely a real person.
He may not have been born, but he definitely came.
We know nothing about any part of his life except that it ended. which is great. Because there is a death certificate. Some people have actually argued that this might not be the George Hepplewhite. It might be whatever George Hepplewhite had been born elsewhere. So there actually is still some contention that the man never existed, and that, for reasons that will become clear in about 2 minutes, it was expounded upon that he was in fact the George Hepplewhite. So he died June 1786. So here's where things start getting more explanatory. His business went to his widow, Alice Hepplewhite.
Okay.
She, rather unusually for the time, continued on the business.
Did she make furniture?
No, she definitely didn't.
Okay.
She ended up employing furniture makers for the firm that got renamed supposedly, although fun fact, we don't know what the shop was called before, A. Hepplewhite and Co.
Now, here's the thing. George doesn't start with an A.
It sure doesn't.
And I'm not, like, a scientician, but I can't help but notice that Alice does start with an A.
It does. Even more fun facts. For a while, other furniture makers thought A. Hepplewhite was his brother. People weren't even aware of his widow for 5 years.
Yeah, because women at this time, if married, were never known by their own first name.
Yeah.
Like, not even to their own husbands.
Yeah. And, like, least of all to the people in his rough milieu. So there was actually some people thought A. Hepplewhite was, like, a mysterious brother no one had met.
Arthur Hepplewhite.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the names posited.
Alfred Hepplewhite.
I don't know about that one.
Aloysius Hepplewhite.
So a lot of people just kind of thought it wasn't strange that the business she supposedly inherited from him was named after her in a purposefully obfuscatory way, such as to conceal that the business was named after her. Later, in 1788, his widow, Alice Hepplewhite, would publish, big air quotes, his book, The Cabinet Maker and Upholsterer's Guide in 1788. This is what he's primarily known for.
The book that only appeared after his death, after his widow, I'm gonna go ahead and say, started a furniture company?
You can say that, yeah. There's, like, here, let's just think, there's nobody to fucking prove you wrong.
So if I can jump ahead 6 steps.
Go ahead.
Alice is interested in cabinets. She marries a cabinet maker who doesn't really do much with his life except die, conveniently leaving her with the respectable station of widow, which in English society at this time gives her a lot more freedom in her movements, such as starting a furniture making business, slapping her own name on it, but pretending it isn't her name because women in the late 1700s, and then publishing her own catalog that she claims is that of her dead husband's that he just didn't have time to publish before he kicked it?
Yeah. Now, this is to, I think, everyone with the sense of that, you know, that God gave little green apples. Stunningly, one of the least popular theories out there. While scanning people who, like, mystery chase this particular issue, I found, I think, out of roughly 23 that had posited this theory.
Are the other theories that Nessie did it?
The other theories are just that he was very private. How private, you might ask?
So private he didn't advertise his own business?
So private that nobody has ever found a stick of furniture he made.
Fiercely private.
Like, to these people, it is actually, like, weirdly more likely that, I did read this theory, that he had, was such a perfectionist that he burnt his stock in a fit of rage shortly before his death.
I mean, hashtag relatable, but I don't think particularly likely.
So, very fun other facts about the book, The Cabinet Maker and Upholsterer's Guide, which, like, it's really important to note is the only thing that made Hepplewhite famous. People only knew his name after this book came out, and that includes Sheridan, Mr. Sheridan, who would go on to just drag the dude for filth. So the book is supposedly George Hepplewhite's posthumous work. The book never mentions George Hepplewhite, either by name or in spirit.
Okay.
There is no foreword referencing George Hepplewhite having made these designs.
Which is weird because literature published throughout that time period, you cannot get to chapter one without going through a foreword and a preface and an introduction and a prologue talking about how somehow furniture making gets you closer to God, and thank you to everyone who helped me along the way.
Oh, it does that.
Okay.
But it doesn't mention George Hepplewhite.
Interesting.
In fact, it publicly advertised later editions that the forewords and all of that talking about getting closer to God, those parts were by A. Hepplewhite. A. Hepplewhite's name is all over the book. No mention of George, though. Despite the fact that it will go down in history as his work.
So, the widow writes the introduction to her late husband's only work without mentioning him?
Without mentioning him.
Okay.
He gets one mention and it's in the title.
But, see, he was so private.
So private.
That on his deathbed, he forbade his widow from ever talking about him ever again. She could, however, publish his only work. But only if she didn't talk about him at any point in the process. It just makes sense.
It just works. To quote cabinet maker Todd Howard. Eventually that book took off. Frequently, furniture makers would make guides with designs. And it took off in a major way and went on to define what some people have called a timeless style of furniture. People seem weirdly okay with the deep and incredibly strange mystery that is, and I'm going to editorialize here, the alacrity with which Alice Hepplewhite engineered this whole situation in her favor.
Yeah, I was going to say, on the mystery scale, this seems closer to a Roanoke than a D.B. Cooper.
You know, there are people who are very unwilling to give up the idea that George Hepplewhite was not in some way a genius.
I mean, he certainly married well.
Yeah, the theory, like, even people who admit that this, like, Hepplewhite was probably the Alice Hepplewhite's brainchild, they still say, like, well, she probably married a virtuoso cabinet maker. To this I ask, well, then why didn't he make anything worth keeping?
Why didn't he make anything we can prove existed?
I cannot stress this enough, we have no proof that even if George Hepplewhite existed, that he made a single piece of furniture. but people are so married to this idea that the most common theory really is that Alice Hepplewhite married a guy who was good at wood and bad at designs. But like, I don't think he was even that good. I think at most he was probably a cabinet maker. Like, sure, I'm sure he was. But you know what? There were a lot of cabinet makers not worth mentioning in history.
Ooh.
Fighting words, I know. So that is the short and bizarre, sort of, mostly easy-to-figure-out mystery of Hepplewhite. And, you know, to me, kind of a really cool story of a woman who engineered a hell of a fortune and legacy.
Yeah.
And it's notable that the designs and the drawing, like even just the technical skill of the drawings, are considered very high quality. So, from the book, to quote A. Hepplewhite, "To unite elegance and utility, and blend the useful with the agreeable, has ever been considered a difficult but honorable task." A. Hepplewhite. So, do you want to hear about what this furniture's like?
Yes.
Because here's the thing, even though there's no such thing as real Hepplewhite, let me start by saying there's no such thing as authentic Hepplewhite. If someone, as mentioned in The Goldfinch, if someone tries to sell you an original Hepplewhite, they are lying. Another thing that surprised the shit out of me was the number of people who were actually willing to go on record and sell things as quote-unquote original Hepplewhite.
And by which they mean original to the cabinet maker Hepplewhite and not made in the Hepplewhite style?
What they mean in reality, it's nefarious doublespeak. Because what they mean is Hepplewhite made during the generally agreed upon time period that would constitute an original Hepplewhite style piece. Like, the closest we can get to original Hepplewhite is Hepplewhite that's made between the 1780s and 1810.
Right. My point was, they are trying to claim it was made by Hepplewhite and not merely saying they're selling a very old piece of furniture made in the Hepplewhite style.
No, they're never claiming anything. They are allowing people to come to that conclusion on their own by saying original. Because you can't really accuse them of lying. But they are, in fact, passively preying upon the fact that people don't know this stuff. So there are people out there who, I think very famously, there is a desk that did belong to Thomas Jefferson that was called an original Hepplewhite.
But there's no record of it ever being sold to him?
Yeah, and yeah.
Also, his name is spelled wrong on the receipt.
Yeah, it says...
It's engraved with his initials.
It says Jefferson? It's weird. Well, no, it's a really famous piece, and there's a lot of provenance to prove it belonged to Thomas Jefferson, and provenance to prove that it came reliably from that time period. It was American, which makes it beyond impossible to be an original George Hepplewhite.
Now, just because we were at war with England at the time doesn't mean we weren't buying their furniture.
Just because we were at war with a country that harbored a man who probably didn't exist, at least as we know him. Doesn't mean he didn't make that desk for a human being he'd literally never heard of in his life. That may not have happened. But they, like, people use the word original. And I don't know if it is pure maliciousness or just that thing where once you're used to something, you just say stuff and not realize how it comes out. But I don't know. It's something to be careful about. So Hepplewhite style is a late Georgian style. I believe it gets called federal when it's American. Because it's from the federal period.
Well, that's just... okay.
It's different from federal furniture, and I know that sucks.
It's not... Words mean things.
Not to antique people, it doesn't. I mean, it's an idea.
No wonder Theo could defraud all of New York City.
It's easy. It's definitely late Georgian, will you agree to that?
Sure.
Okay. Oh, here's something it's definitely neoclassic. You can't argue with that one, because that's just about design.
I mean, I can't because I've never seen it, so I don't know if it resembles the classical style.
It's influenced heavily by the classical style. The Hepplewhite style came about after Chippendale and before too congruent with Sheridan, which would absolutely become a thing with Sheridan.
Is Sheridan bitter?
Intensely bitter. I don't think Sheridan published a book that didn't include a segment where he slagged on Hepplewhite, because they very likely borrowed from each other. They were both influenced by a lot of the furniture makers at their time, and so their designs have a lot of similarities. And Sheridan, being the one who lived and also probably existed, got the dubious honor of being the guy to bitch about it for the rest of time.
I love antiques feuds.
It's so good. So it does overlap with Sheridan a lot. So Hepplewhite is best known for delicacy, ornate design, combined with simple, clean, geometric shapes. In most of the pieces, it was also known for its serpentine designs, which just means that they were curvy in the front.
So when I think curvy, I don't think neoclassical. Is that wrong?
It's not wrong. It borrows from neoclassical. It doesn't copy it to the letter.
Okay, so it sounds... because, like, when you say curvy, I think for this time period, especially, like, Baroque and Rococo.
That's what it's borrowing from. Imagine Baroque and Rococo, but clean.
Baroque and Rococo neoclassical sounds like a hell of a time.
Well, here's the thing. It made an impact for a reason. It was like nothing anyone had seen before.
Yeah, I bet. I've combined a circle and a square. Wanna see?
So, like, the word that comes up a lot is curvilinear.
Curvilinear?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, clean lines and curves married together. Ah, what bliss. The only ornamentation was usually in the actual structure of the piece and or veneering and inlay. Unlike Chippendale and other, like, Baroque and Rococo pieces, which they relied on heavy carving, right? Like, all the detail was carved into the wood. In this, the furniture itself was made of the details. Does that make sense?
I'm having difficulty understanding the distinction.
It was all clean lines, right? There was almost no carving. Except for what was used to make inlay. So everything was smooth. Like a baby's bottom.
Okay.
You got it?
Yes.
But those designs themselves, like, you know how people do, like, very fancy scroll saw work?
Yes.
Yeah, like that.
Okay.
It became very well known for its deeply ornate inlay.
It's just that when you said there was no carving, I thought you meant they just picked up pieces of wood that happened to already be shaped like furniture.
Ah, no. I figured that was going to be like... As soon as it came into my mouth, I was like, that was a bad sentence.
So no decorative carving.
No decorative carving.
All the decoration is inlay that is flush with the curves already present in the piece.
Yes.
Okay.
And or in the curves that made up the piece. But there wasn't any incision into the wood. Other than what was... You know, you said it better than me.
Okay.
These also paired with the legs. The legs were a huge thing with Hepplewhite. The legs were always as simple as they could be, and almost always as straight as they could be.
Boring.
No. They're beautiful.
Boring.
Stop it. It's beautiful.
Boring.
No, they're graceful.
Give me giant animal paws.
Well, you're gonna love what happens to Hepplewhite later.
Yes.
So, Hepplewhite is pretty much defined by a lack of cabriole, which is outward curving legs, which create the big animal paws of which you so crave.
Those are the best kind of leg!
A lot of people also thought that. So his were either a square taper, also called a Marlborough. That's pretty simple. Classical Roman Greek column styles. Or tapered round down to either a spade foot, which just a spade-shaped chunk of wood that carried the weight, or what they call the spider leg, which is just a round taper that gets real tiny at the bottom.
Little spider paws?
Little spide paws.
I hate it.
When they were that thin, they had 8 stretchers. They endeavored to make them invisible pieces of wood that connected the legs so that they could actually bear weight, while still looking that delicate. So it's all about straight, minimal ornamentation, delicate little legs. Like, ideally the piece looked like it shouldn't be able to function, but had to be constructed in such a way that it did. Another thing that it was a classic of the style, contrasting veneer colors, also called marquetry. So you would have mahogany, very heavy in a mahogany, and then you would get a bright, light-colored satin wood to do all of the inlaying with. And sometimes you would have upwards of 3 to 4 to 5 different kinds of woods all in one inlay design. And they would all wildly contrast the original wood color. The inlay designs were usually natural or classical. You get shells, bellflowers, urns, trees, ribbons, kind of that stuff. Like I mentioned before, he had the Prince of Wales feather, which is a peacock feather. And this was included because of his famed connection with the Prince of Wales, which didn't happen.
Fraudulent peacock.
The woods used include mahogany, mahogany, and more mahogany, but also satinwood, maple, tulip wood, sycamore, birch, and rosewood, with those soft woods generally being inlay. And the American woods were ash and pine, because this style took off way harder in America than it ever did in Britain. Because the Americans were simple. To put it mildly.
That's a charitable way of phrasing it.
When you think about American design, it definitely trends towards...
folksy.
Folksy, practical to a fault, I would say. Lacking in all charm.
Blatantly obvious we didn't have art schools.
And we didn't value them either. So when they saw Hepplewhite shit, which was like, oh, we finally sent someone to art school.
We finally combined circles and squares.
Yeah, and so they like lost their minds over it. So this is considered like a classical American style, especially.
Oh God.
Alice is also credited with inventing tambours, which were vertical strips of wood glued to a background cloth to make a little hidden cubbyhole.
I understand you mean that Alice actually invented it, but I think it's also fair to say that George is credited with the invention.
You are correct. Thank you. Yes.
Because it's more likely that a man we can't prove existed made this furniture than a woman started a business.
God.
Why does this tree say Croatan? Why do all of the natives here have blue eyes?
Wait, where are we? Oh, we're on Croatan Island. I bet this has no connection to the other thing.
We'll never find Roanoke now.
It's such a fucking mystery. And what's more, probably a supernatural one.
Il est disparu.
Au revoir.
A bientôt.
God, what a day that must have been for the indigenous peoples of Croatoan Island.
I have to imagine that it's just everyone whispering behind their back, no one tell them. Tell them this is amazing.
They're like holding one of their like blonde babies, like, this is gonna be so fucking funny. Like
it's gonna be so hilarious when they finally figured it out. Joke's on them. They never fucking figured it out.
Generations past, they're just like, I think today's gonna be the day. Finally, someone sees the American Horror Story, and they're just like, they're never gonna do it, huh? They're never gonna, like, calls his great-grandma up, like, great-grandma's never gonna happen.
I see you the American Horror Story version and raise you the Sleepy Hollow version.
Oh, the Sleepy Hollow version is good.
The Sleepy Hollow version was bizonkers. Anyway, Heppelwhite.
So, Heppelwhite, the most famous thing, absolute most famous, and one of the most enduring elements of the design, the shield back chair.
This fucker.
Oh, you hate the shield back chair.
I don't hate the shield back chair, but...
But you hate the shield back chair.
Pray, continue. Tell me about this shield backed chair.
Well, there's not much to say about it other than it's a shield
shape. Is it the back of a chair shaped like a shield?
Yeah, pretty much. This was incredibly novel at the time.
Amazing. Because we didn't fucking have shields here. Because we weren't, like, digging up medieval artifacts in our backyards every 5 minutes.
Oh, no, the shield back actually was one of the designs that did very well in Britain.
Really?
Because they were like, oh, blimey gov, I have a shield. I don't know, do people have shields in the 1700s? You're the history guy. Hilariously on this podcast about history.
I'm going to, once again, reference the digging up medieval artifacts in their backyard every 5 minutes.
Right, yeah, so they were like, oh, it looks like that. I like this chair now. Oh, I lost my accent. Guess I gotta go to America. Like, I mentioned the shield back just because it is the most enduring, I think, maybe, furniture design of all time. I would actually go that far to say, if you look at a shield back chair, you've definitely seen one before, and it is almost, what's the word I'm thinking of?
Cliche? Stereotypical?
Like, yeah, but in a
iconic?
Nice way. But yeah, iconic. Yeah, thank you. Stereotypical, but in a good way.
Iconic.
Yeah, so just that. He actually volleyed between shield backs and just, like, these oval shapes, which I actually greatly prefer personally. But the shield back is worth mentioning. And usually the shield backs were... The shield shape was made up of these beautiful scrolling designs. And to quote a rather salty admirer, at its best, the taste was so fine and so full of distinction, so simple, modest, and sufficient, that it amounted to genius. On its lower planes, it was clearly influenced by commercialism, and the desire to make what tasteless people prefer. Yet this is no more than to say that the Heppelwhite style succumbed sometimes, perhaps very often, to the eternal enemy of all art, the uninspired banality of the average man.
Can I get that, like, tattooed?
I was, like, really internally betting, like, Ken's gonna agree with this motherfucker hard.
Smash that reblog button.
That is credited to a cabinet maker known only as JPB.
You go, JP. JP gets it.
So, later Heppelwhite, it would go through a really big revival in the 1880s, because the Victorians really liked classicism, classical, neoclassical, all of it, ate it up. But, wasn't fancy enough for them, so you start seeing changes and incorporations such as cabriole legs and carving.
Is this perhaps the distinction that is intended by the language original Heppelwhite?
This is probably what they mean. I sincerely hope not in an obfuscatory fashion.
Original Heppelwhite being made in the late 1700s, whereas non-original Heppelwhite being made in the 1880s revival.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very probable. But like I said, keep your neck on a swivel.
Just the neck.
Just the neck. I don't want you swiveling anything else, please.
The head and torso must remain in place.
I find the swivel...
Only the neck must spin between them.
I find the swiveling of the human body to be incredibly distasteful. And dare I say sinful, so please, limit the swiveling.
To the vertebra between the skull and collarbone. Just swiveling wildly.
I was possessed by Quaker for a second there.
On the dowel of the spinal cord.
And no further. So this is one of those... just really enjoying that.
It's like a fucking rolling pin.
Like one of those good ones that pivots between the handles. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I expect you to do in the presence of Heppelwhite.
I'll get right on it.
Start now. So when you talk reproductions with Heppelwhite, obviously the word reproduction is a bit wiggity-whack here. Because you can't reproduce something that never properly existed outside of a style.
Sorry, my mind just got blown for a second.
Yeah, you just realized that, huh? Yeah, I'm good at that. There was, for all intents and purposes, a reproduction of early designs made by a variety of other cabinet makers, reproduced by Kittinger Furniture of Buffalo in the 1920s and 1930s. These are considered to be very valuable, actually.
because it's right before a certain economic event.
Yes, that. Well, that just, it's never going to stop coming up. yeah, mostly just, it was really high quality. They were very beautiful. And nowadays they're antique in their own right. So they're not bad furniture. It's just a matter of, you have to be mindful of age. And I don't want to get too bogged down in describing how to determine age in furniture. We have a bunch of episodes about it if you want to know more about it. Really roughly, you look at hardware, you look at wood quality, you look at production methods, joining is really important, you know, dovetailing over the use of hardware, in fact. That kind of thing, like wear on the feet. Just kind of, like, it's really rough with Hepplewhite because I mentioned in the 1880s that it got remixed.
Just read The Goldfinch and you'll know.
Read The Goldfinch and you'll buy an original Hepplewhite made by the man himself.
No. Learn from their mistakes.
As for telling apart from Sheridan, which is actually considered a huge sticking point and probably what made Sheridan so salty in the first place, the easiest way to do it is the curves. Hepplewhite's pieces always, always had unbroken lines the entire length of, say, a chair, for example, made with curves. Sheridan, always rectangular. So, to quote another cabinet maker, one essential item of contrast will always serve to differentiate clearly the individual styles of Hepplewhite and Sheridan, no matter how many points of resemblance they may display in other respects. Sheridan admired and emphasized the straight line in every possible place, while Hepplewhite, on the contrary, was a faithful exponent of the curvilinear tendency that became so popular in the late 17th and early 18th centuries.
So Hepplewhite's curvier?
He's got those curves, honey. Yeah, pretty much just that. So that is the wonderful, wide, wacky, weird story of Hepplewhite and how it's not a real thing, turns out.
It's not real and it never happened. And if it did happen, it definitely wasn't Alice.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I know a man has to have been involved. A man did it, I know it.
What about the men?
What about the men in this story? Well, I mean, Sheridan's there. He's not happy about it.
Sheridan's the only one who cares about the men.
He's the only one. Oh, Sheridan man. Said men's rights. God. So, sources for today include EnglishClassics.net, George Hepplewhite's Furniture Contributions, thesprucecrafts.com, Hepplewhite Style Furniture, Furnishing the Home of Good Taste, a brief sketch of the period styles and interior decoration, with suggestions as to their employment in the homes of today, by Lucy Abbott Throop.
I'm guessing she was writing in the 1880s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Britannica.com, George Hepplewhite, CollectorsWeekly.com, article titled Hepplewhite Combined Straight Lines and Pulled Curves, just really cutting to the heart of it, Buffaloa, BUFFALOAH.com, Hepplewhite. The Practical Book of Period Furniture by Harold Donaldson Eberlein and Abbott McClure. And my new favorite website of all time, OldAndSold.com. Because we had to have at least one that just cuts to the heart of things.
And The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
And The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, which would have been better if it was about divorce in Las Vegas.
Jesus Christ. Never letting it go.
Not on my life.
Thank you for introducing me to George Hepplewhite, my new favorite cryptid.
Yeah, if you've like got...
him and Mothman are neck and neck.
Oh, I'm going to Cripplegate, and I'm going to find him.
More like Cryptidgate.
And that's... Cryptidgate also describes the conspiracy to hide Hepplewhite from us. Bring him out, England, we know you've got him.
If you would like to tell us where George Hepplewhite is hiding...
Tell me!
Email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks and join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends.
Where you can share grainy photos of people you think might be George Hepplewhite. Or is it a man in a gorilla costume?
If you would like to purchase some vintage goods, you can check out our Etsy at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks.
Coming up soon, a cup with Santa Claus on it that bafflingly just says, always drink milk.
Amazing. For deleted scenes, you can head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks. And while you're there, you can join the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
One that definitely exists.
Unlike George Hepplewhite.
Yeah, yeah, and if you liked this, if you liked anything we've ever done in our entire lives, and you think that other people should listen to us, For better or worse, please consider dropping down to whatever you're listening to this on and leaving us a 5-star review, please. 5 stars would be nice. Or you can just say whatever the hell you're actually feeling. Either way, helps us out a great deal.
Rate it number stars. Type in word text.
It could just say, corn dogs? ? And that's fine.
It would be a great place to input your opinion on who the real George Heppelwhite is.
Yeah, if you've got tips, please leave it there. Give us the number of stars that rate the likelihood that George Heppelwhite existed on a scale of 1 to 5.
Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to our goal of releasing bonus episodes. And thank you for listening.
You especially.
Goodbye.
Bye.